Like Aaron said, my name is Jeff Shoemaker. My wife Angie and I, we've been at Summit View here for about 17 years. I think I know a number of you, but for those of you who don't know me, other than the guy who makes a lot of noise back there on occasional Sundays, I have a family. We have 5 kids. Our youngest is 15. My kids always say that whenever I teach, I make fun of one of them or I embarrass one of them. Today is our youngest, Micah's, opportunity. Just hold on, wait for that. We have 4 other kids. They're all graduated. Our 2 oldest girls are married. This is a picture on the top here of our middle daughter, Aaliyah, her and Reeve, who are part of 242 here, got married this past summer. Our oldest daughter, Kayan, and her husband, Michael, this fall had a beautiful baby girl who is smiley, and I know what you're thinking, and it's what I think all the time, too. I'm way too young to be a grandpa. And you're right, I am. But it is an exciting stage of life, and we're thrilled about it. My wife helped me put together the pictures for this slideshow. She sent them to me. And one of the pictures was my bike, and I said, why did you include that? And she said, well, I don't know. You talk about it so much, it's practically a part of our family. And I didn't disagree with her, so it made the cut. As you guys know, we've started off this year with a short little 3-part series. This is the last one of those. But really, at the beginning of the year, it's common for us to make sometimes resolutions, sometimes just personal commitments. Sometimes we just think to ourselves, you know, this next year I want to improve my walk with God, or I want to improve my physical health, or I want to improve my financial health in some way. And so we thought, what a good time to just stop and look at those topics and say, what does it really mean to walk in godliness and to have, God infused in all those aspects of our life? And what does it mean to please God through our everyday actions as we think about growing spiritually, as we think about growing, you know, in maturing physically, as we think about improving in our finances. So 2 weeks ago, Mark Saunders was up here and he spoke and he gave us this illustration of a bookshelf, right? So here's a bookshelf and we put things on that bookshelf and it fills up our life. So we have work, it takes a big slot. It's a big, wide, fat book. We have chores. In Mark's example, there were a lot of chores for some reason, as John pointed out last week. We have our finances, we have exercise, we have our hobbies, we have our relationship with God, our spiritual walk. And those things are all items in that bookshelf. But really, as we think about godliness, the goal isn't just to make that spiritual book fatter and fatter and fatter. What we want is we want that slice to actually infuse every other aspect of our life. We want our faith to permeate everything we do and impact how we think and how we approach our health, our hobbies, our work, our finances, everything. So last week, John, I thought, did an excellent job up here talking about how our faith should impact how we think about exercise in our physical bodies, how we honor God through what we eat, how we work out, how we sleep. That it's not the utmost important thing, but it is of some value. And this week I have the very enviable task of talking about everyone's favorite topic, and that's money. And we love talking about money, except for we don't. We hardly ever talk about it in our culture. And it's especially awkward for some reason talking about that in church. And I'll get to why I think that is in a moment. But if I were to ask you guys right now just to pause and turn to somebody in a pew next to you and who isn't your spouse, and just share 3 things with them. Share how much you made last year, how much debt you currently have, and how much you gave last year, we would all understandably kind of freak out for a moment. Many of you would feel a sense of fear, some shame, maybe some guilt. Some of you would just get up and walk out the door and be like, I'm not participating in that at all. And it's understandable. We have a lot of fear maybe about how we compare to other people. We probably have some shame, maybe, if we have debt that we feel like we shouldn't have. Might have some guilt because we don't give the way we think we should. There can be all kinds of reasons. Money is a very thorny topic, and actually, Jesus talks more about money in the New Testament than he talks about heaven and hell combined. I think that's an interesting statistic, in part because the reason Jesus came to the earth was to seek and save the lost. So he literally came to earth to take people who were on the path to hell and drag them into the kingdom of heaven, to point them to the kingdom of heaven. So you'd think he'd spend most of his time talking about hell and heaven. I think the reason he talks so much about money, though, is because, like we discussed just a minute ago, we want our faith to impact every area of our life. Money actually does impact every single area of our life. We get up and we go to work so we can make money, so we can buy the food to fuel our bodies and make us healthy, so that we can buy workout equipment and support our hobbies and help our kids get education and do all the good things in life that we have to do. But money is an undercurrent in all of that. And I think Jesus says if we want holiness to really be something that permeates our life, we have to deal with the question of money first. We have to tackle that topic. But before we go too much further, I actually want to stop and pause for a minute. I want to read a verse that actually underpins this entire series. We said, you know, series about godliness and what it means to please God in the everyday. And that comes from Hebrews 11:6, which says, "And without faith, it is impossible to please God." So the inverse of that is, it is possible to please God with faith. "But without faith, it is impossible to please God. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him." So, the good news is that we can please God, and we do that by having faith, right? So what is faith? Well, I think this passage gives us a definition of faith, and I think it's a good one. If we said faith, I think at the very end here, it tells us that those who would draw near to God must believe that he exists. So faith is believing God exists, right? Well, yes, in part. It's hard to have faith if you don't even believe God exists. But similarly, I don't think that's quite fully it. If we continue reading, we see, "And we must believe that he rewards those who seek him." And that's something that's really struck me in the last couple weeks as I've prepared this message, is looking and going, it's not enough just to believe that God exists. That's not the kind of faith that pleases God. The kind of faith that pleases God is a faith that believes he exists, and of equal value, of equal importance, is that we also have to believe that God is one who rewards us when we seek him. So one big takeaway today, I think for all of us, is that God is a God who rewards, who desires to reward us. Oftentimes, I think, if we say to ourselves that we're really going to go all in, we're going to live a radical life, we're going to devote ourselves entirely to wherever, whatever God calls us to, somewhere in the back of our mind, I think we fear that God's going to ask the same thing of us that he asked of the rich young ruler, which is to give up everything we have and come and follow him. And in our limited thinking and our limited understanding of God, what we often do then is go, well, that's going to mean a life that's marked by austerity and lack and suffering, and as a result, I'm not going to have access to the things that I would like or need, and so I'm going to lack joy, I'm going to lack comfort, I'm going to lack peace. And we look at a life like that, we say, that is not the kind of life that I want for myself. Even if there's a future reward, right now that sounds like something that is just too difficult to embrace. And so we tend to just shut down a little bit and say, I don't even want to engage with this concept or this talk about money because I don't want to open the possibility that God might call me for the next 40 years of my life, 30 years of my life, 60 years of my life to suffer. But today, what I want us to do is not so much focus on what God may or may not be calling us to give up. Instead, throughout this message today, I want us to focus on what God is actually calling us into. There's a parable that Jesus shares. It's in Matthew 13. I'll put it up here on the screen. But in Matthew 13, Jesus gives this parable. He says, "The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field that a man found and covered up. Then in his joy, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field." Sometimes we read verses, or I read verses, and I just kind of read through it. I've read it so many times. But this verse, for some reason, it always conjures this image for me. And the image it conjures is this. It's kind of a movie playing in my head. So I'll take you on a little journey through my mind, and it's a scary place. But I imagine a guy who's walking down the road. In particular, what he's doing, he's walking down Shields near Harmony. And there's an empty field there that has been there since the day I moved to Fort Collins, and there's like a line of pine trees that run right down the middle of this field. It's very odd. And I imagine that there's a big sign there. It says REMAX, lot for sale. And this guy goes, that's interesting. And he kind of wanders through the field a little bit, goes into the trees where all the pine needles have fallen over the years and the leaves have blown in. And he sees a big pile. And he says, that's kind of odd. He brushes it away. And what he sees there astonishes him. He notices a 13th century pirate's treasure chest, you know, the kind with the kind of domed lid. And he opens it up and it creaks open. It's been there for thousands of years and it still works just flawlessly, hundreds of years at least. And he immediately notices it's full of gold doubloons. And this man just happens to be a connoisseur of all things 13th century pirate and gold. And he looks and goes, that value there has to be at least $100 million. So he immediately covers it all back up. He goes out, he calls REMAX, says, hey, that lot you have for sale, how much? And they say, like $500,000, something like that. And he goes, huh. And he goes home, and he's sleeping in bed that night, and he thinks to himself, well, I have some money in my 401k. I've got a little bit of money saved up, but I don't have that much money. How can I get that treasure? And then he continues to ponder, and he thinks to himself, well, if I sold my cars, if I sold a lot of my possessions, I still wouldn't have enough. If I sold my house and everything in it, including all my clothes except for the clothes that I'm wearing right now, then I think I might be just capable of affording that field. But man, I really like my house. I like my little middle-income house in the middle of Fort Collins. All of us would be like, fool, sell it all. Go get the $100 million. You can do whatever you want in that point, right? Him holding on to this little treasure when there's a huge treasure being offered feels ridiculous. And the truth of the matter is we have no understanding and no knowledge as to why 13th century pirates were in Fort Collins and why no one noticed this treasure till now. Someday when we are in heaven, we can ask God that question. But I like this parable because I think what it does is it helps us to see that I think sometimes we cling to the treasure we have in our lives. We cling to the blessings that God has provided us today. And we're afraid to possibly give those up for some greater treasure. And I think ultimately it's because we don't understand how great a treasure is being offered to us. We actually have a very limited view sometimes of God and his goodness and what he can provide for us. So today, I'm going to take us through Luke 12. We're going to spend most of the rest of our time in that passage. And before we jump in there, I just want to pray for us, pray for the rest of our time together. So if you would, just close your eyes with me and we'll continue on here. Well, God, we thank you for your grace in our lives. We thank you that every good and perfect gift that we have today, it comes from you. God, and I pray that we wouldn't be people who cling to our temporary blessings and we lose sight of the greatest blessing, which is you and your Son. Help us to have a greater view of you today. Help enlarge in our hearts. God, I pray that you would help me speak true words this morning. God, I pray that our ears would hear the things that are specific to us that you want us to hear today, God. Thank you for your grace. Thank you that you offer redemption and that there is no condemnation for us. And God, that you love us and are a father who constantly provides for us. Help us to see that more clearly today as we go on. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. All right, like I said, we're going to go through Luke chapter 12, there's a parable that Jesus gives here, so if you want to open in your house Bible, this is going to be on page 871. And I'm just going to set this up really briefly. It starts actually in verse 13, we're going to start reading in verse 16. But at the beginning of this, a man comes to Jesus and asks Jesus, he says, hey, Jesus, tell my brother to split the inheritance with me. We know no background, we know no details about this. In Jesus' time, it was very common that the oldest son got the majority of the inheritance. So we don't know if this is a younger sibling coming and saying, hey, Jesus, it was divided the way that our culture says, but it's not fair. Tell him to divide it. Or it could just be that one was hoarding the money and not giving it to the other. But Jesus stops him and says, this isn't my problem. I'm not going to tell you how to divide it. I'm not your arbiter. But he says, be on your guard against all covetousness. This guy might have had a rightful claim to this money, but Jesus pauses and says, be on your guard against covetousness, because your life does not consist of the items that you own, of your physical possessions. That is not what your life amounts to. It's so much more. And so he starts in verse 16. And we can read together. I'll put it up on the screen here too. And he said to them, 16. And he told them a parable saying, the land of the rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what should I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. I think the rich fool, and that's what we're going to call this person here, the rich fool, he makes three mistakes. And actually in this parable, we're going to contrast two different types of people. The first one is the rich fool. I think they both make three mistakes, and I think those mistakes are very similar in nature. They're just the opposite side of the same coin. But the rich fool, he makes three mistakes, and we're going to go through those briefly here. The first is he thought that his life was his own. He believed that he answered only to himself. You see this very specifically in the way he talks. He's not praying. He's thinking to himself. He says, I do. I have my crops. I will. My barns. He keeps using this language all throughout. He never once says, God's provision, God's crops, God's blessing. He never looks to other people around him and thinks how he might be generous to the community at large with this abundant surplus of goods. I think a lot of times we think that we are the masters of our own destiny. We are the people who have gone to school. We have done the hard work. We have gained notoriety in our jobs. We have earned the wealth that we have. And that's all on us, and so we deserve it. And to give it away, to release it out there, is something that we don't necessarily need to do because it's ours. It doesn't belong to anyone else. We have this kind of mentality at times. I think this is really interesting here because obviously he had no control over the weather, over how it rained, over the amount of sunshine, over any natural events. He just produced, there's a plentiful crop that was produced, and he assumes it's all him, all that he did. So I think that's his first mistake. His second mistake is that he thought his security actually came through accumulating more and more. He didn't want to rely on other people. Ultimately, he doesn't want to rely on God either. And so he's just storing up and saying, now I have enough. At this point, my soul can finally be satisfied. I can rest. I can eat, drink, and be merry because I have enough. But the truth of the matter is when we hoard, what we're really saying is we don't ever feel like we have enough. We always need a little bit more. I think we are a culture that likes to build bigger barns. We're constantly looking to how we can get more, how we can be more self-reliant. For me personally, I always think about this, and I'm guilty of this, I think about it as it relates to power tools. I am a software engineer. I like to do some house projects. I can be somewhat handy. I live in a cul-de-sac, and there's like 10 other houses in our cul-de-sac. No one in our cul-de-sac works in construction. But I guarantee you that every single one of us owns the exact same power tools. And we all use those exact same power tools twice a year. But we don't want to have to rely on each other. I don't want to have to go to my neighbor and say, hey, I got a piece of door trim to cut. Can I borrow your miter saw? Instead, I want to go spend hundreds of dollars so that when I need to cut that one piece of trim in 2 years, I don't have to rely on anyone but myself. We like building bigger barns. But I think there's a good thing for our soul when we rely on other people. because I think it helps us actually remember that we ultimately are reliant upon God. We had no ability to save ourselves. We had no ability to affect our own salvation. That is a free gift that came from God. And as a culture, we're very bad at accepting free gifts. Thirdly, I think this rich fool thought he had time. He had made this plan. He had had an abundant crop. He's going to build bigger barns so he can relax into the future. He didn't think about the needs of others. He just planned for the future. And he has no clue what's going to happen in the future. He has no idea that that very night, God is going to demand his life of him. He's got a very closed fist around his financial resources. And as a result, he's not even recognizing or aware of the fact that he's never even going to be able to make use of those resources. So these are the three mistakes, or at least three of the mistakes, that I think this rich fool makes. And I'll tell you what, when I first read this verse, when I was first a Christian, or this passage, I was really challenged by it, because one of the questions that I came away from it was, am I a fool if I decide to save any of my money? Should I just not plan for the future? Should I not put money away into a retirement account? At that time, I was 15, so I still had a couple years to worry about that. And I think the answer is, this passage is not about telling people that we shouldn't save. The right answer isn't, no, just live paycheck to paycheck. That's the godly way to live. In fact, Proverbs really affirms saving. We see in the NIV, it says, the wise store up choice food and olive oil, but fools gulp theirs down. So it's wise for us to actually have a little bit left over, to store up a little bit for the future in some capacity. Proverbs 30, 8b through 9, while not necessarily talking about saving, does kind of give us a way that, you know, Proverbs thinks about finances. It says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? And I think that's what the rich fool does, right? He is full and he says, who's the Lord? I don't need him. Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. So there's not necessarily or inherently value in either one of those extremes. It's not more honorable to be holy and it is more honorable to be holy. It's not more honorable to be wealthy. It's also not more honorable to be poor. We see a number of people through Scripture who actually had a great degree of wealth, and the Bible seems to commend them. We have Abraham, Job, Lydia, who was the seller of purple goods. We see Joseph of Arimathea, who had a tomb that Jesus was laid in. So I think the tension for us is that God isn't necessarily condemning saving or planning for the future necessarily, but what I think he is condemning is an attitude that hoards and a feeling that says, I never have enough. I always need a little bit more to be secure. And the question I think really boils down to, are we disciplined enough to live and to save and to live on less than we make? Last week, John made a great point about exercise. He said, exercise is difficult, but exercise is an arena where we are able to actually practice our godliness because it requires a certain degree of discipline. And planning for the future and saving and living on less than we make is a similar arena. It's an arena where we get to practice godliness because it's an opportunity to say, I'm not going to just exercise my flesh. I'm not going to just give in to pleasures right now. If I'm going to save a little bit for the future, I might not be able to go and eat out as much as I would like to. Or I might have to hold off on this purchase that isn't absolutely necessary, but it's something that I want. It requires a discipline, and it requires us to stop and go, there's a future that I'm longing for. There's a future that I'm aiming towards. In the same way, though, I think we can sometimes read through this passage and go, you know what? We can let our lack of discipline become a bit of an excuse. Well, I don't know if God actually ever wants me to retire. I don't know if I need to do that down the road. I can live paycheck to paycheck, and actually, I think I'm living more by faith. I will say this. I think that's actually okay if you're truly living by faith and if that's something that God has called you into. But I think sometimes we just find ourselves in that situation. We find ourselves overspending. And then we backfill God into that as an excuse for why we're not being as disciplined as we should be. So, a couple things. I think, first of all, both of these extremes lack faith, right? If we're putting money away, if we're hoarding cash, if we're holding on to it in a tight-fisted way, what we're saying is God can't be trusted, and that I must be the provider for myself. It's all on me. The second way is to say, well, I'm a spendthrift. I just spend what I get, and ultimately God doesn't expect my planning or my involvement. But I think there's a different way. I think we want to live in faith. And I think one way that faith can look is to say, listen, I'm going to save for the future. I'm going to live wisely, but I'm also going to live generously. And I'm going to trust God ultimately with those outcomes. So how do we do that? We're going to get to that in a little bit. But first, I actually want to pause for just a minute. And I want to acknowledge one thing. So far, I've started from a place that says, hey, we probably all, to some degree, make a livable wage. We all probably have the ability to maybe put some money aside and to save a little bit. But I do need to acknowledge that all of us in this room are in very different financial places. And some of us may be like, Jeff, there's just no hope with the amount of money that I make that I'm going to really be able to save. It's a struggle every day. I live within that poverty limit, and that can be very difficult. I think sometimes when we've lived in an affluent culture, in an affluent town, it's easy to look maybe down on people or to feel if we're more or less well off. It's easy to look and assume that people are looking down on our financial situation. I think the first thing is we need to acknowledge that the causes and the reasons for poverty are very complex. And so it's not just an easy cut and dry, this person made poor choices. Tim Keller, who is a pastor and author, really gave three reasons that he thinks that people suffer from poverty. And the first is just oppression or systemic injustice. This can be the fact that, you know, maybe you were a harder worker, but you got passed over for the promotion that you deserved because of internal politicking or because of various reasons. Someone could have taken advantage of you wrongfully, and as a result, you're unable to get the work that you should be able to get, or you've lost money that should have been yours. The second reason he gives is because of calamity or circumstance. That can be a sudden illness that causes you to be unable to work, that causes massive medical bills. It could be a loss of a job. It could be a sudden economic downturn that affects your industry. And thirdly, the thing that he mentions is that it could just be a personal moral failure, that's hard to say. It can be poor choices. It could be lack of discipline. But whatever it is, whatever reasons are the base cost or the basis of why someone struggles with poverty, what we have to realize is it's not because God, or it is not an indication that God is displeased with this person. In the same way that having wealth is not an indication that God is pleased with that person, we see examples of people who are wealthy who God is pleased with, and examples of people who are wealthy that God is highly displeased with, and vice versa when it comes to poverty. We see Job. Job was completely blameless, and yet he lost everything. And ultimately, we see Jesus, who himself was God, and he became a human just like us. He became poor for our sake. That's what 2 Corinthians 8:9 says. And we need to remember, even as he became a human and gave up all the benefits of godhood, he didn't stop there. He let us poor, wretched, pitiful people, accuse him, abuse him, oppress him, and ultimately take everything he had from him. We took his very life. And he gladly laid that down. He gladly gave it up so that he could give us the greatest treasure. So, there is no value judgment on a person based on their wealth or if they struggle with poverty. And if you do struggle with poverty, the second call for us, I think, is just like the call to the person with a lot of money. It's to faith and not a formula. We have a Father who can provide all of our needs. We'll see that shortly. And we see a lot of examples in Scripture of people who had very little, but their faith and the way they lived their lives pleased God immensely. And this is where I get to embarrass my son. This is Micah, our 15-year-old. This is when he was 6. And at that time, my wife was homeschooling a number of our kids still. So we had a room in our house that was dedicated to schooling. We called it the school room, appropriately. And this was a desk. It's all beat up and scratched up because it's where all our kids sat around and did their schoolwork. And one morning she came down and there was some random change lined up in this perfect row. And she asked our kids, does anyone know where this money came from? And Micah was beaming and he said, yes, Mom, I gave you that money because I love you and because you teach me, but you don't get paid like other teachers. And so he gave her some money. And this is appropriate because this is about the amount of money. It's 41 cents. That's about what a teacher makes. Thank you, all you teachers out there. We later found out this was all the money that Micah had. And I will tell you that this could have been 100 times as much, and it would have meant less. This small gift was Micah saying, here's some money, Mom, and I just want to give it to you to show you that I love you, that I'm thankful for what you do. And it meant so much for her. It didn't mean anything for us financially. In fact, I think we'd given that money to Micah as a part of an allowance, and this was what was remaining after something was probably purchased. But the amount was meaningful. And we see another example in Scripture where Jesus was in the synagogue and people are coming up and they're giving their offering and they're putting it in the collection box. And all these people are putting money in, and then this widow comes up and she puts in 2 coins. And Jesus says this. He says, truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box, for they contributed out of their abundance. But she, out of her poverty, has put in everything that she had to live on. In the same way that Micah gave his mom all the money that he had, and he trusted that he was still going to have his needs met, that he was going to have food, that he was going to have shelter, that he would have clothing, and he would. This widow put in everything, knowing that she could trust God's provision. And I will say that there are some of you in this room right now that every month you give faithfully to this church and to others around you who are in need, and it is a sacrifice, and God does not miss that. He sees it. He is honored by it. You write a check, and you know it means that you're not going to get to go out to lunch as often as you want to. That you're not going to buy, it's going to take you longer to buy that thing that you might want to get, or you might not be able to get it at all. Conversely, there are some in this room that have enough money that every month a check is auto-withdrawn from their bank account and sent to the church. And at the end of the year, they look at a giving statement, and they go, oh, that's how much I gave. And it didn't affect how they lived their life, how they spent their money. It was just that cream off the top. And while I don't think that God is displeased with that by any means, and by the way, thank you if you give, I do think that if we don't even have to feel it going out, that that might be an opportunity for us to reflect and say, would God be asking something a little bit more of me? Would he ask me to maybe increase that amount a little bit so I feel the pain a little bit of that money going away, so I can know that it's not just me who provides, and it's not me who provides for this church or the needs in my community. It's God who provides both for me and for them. And he sometimes does that through me, and he sometimes does that through the graciousness and the generousness of other people. But ultimately, it's God who provides. So I want to continue on here, and we're going to keep reading here in Luke, starting in verse 22, Luke 12. And Jesus carries on. He says, and he said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, nor about your body, what you will put on. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to the span of his life? If then you are not able to do a small thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? I lost my place on this slide. I'm going to move it forward. Nope, I went forward already. Nope, back. All right. And now I lost my place here. If then you are not able to do a small thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you are to eat and what you are to drink, nor be worried, for the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. So, we saw the errors of the rich fool. But I also think there's three errors, and like I said, I think they're the opposite side of the same coin, for the anxious person. So Jesus switches tact here, and he starts talking about, don't be anxious. It's not worth it. And the three errors that they have, first of all, is they think that their provision depends on themselves. Just like the rich fool. The rich fool said, my crops, my barns, my goods. He thought he was the source. The anxious person, on the other hand, makes themselves the source as well. They just do it without the confidence. It is ultimately the same self-reliance. It's just a totally different emotional tone, right? So they're going, if I can just worry enough, if I can plan enough, if I can just be stressed out enough about this, maybe I can somehow affect a change. And we need to realize that if God cares for the birds, who have no ability to care for themselves or plan at all, how much more is he going to care for us who bear his image? Secondly, they think that worry gives them control. You know, the rich fool thought that building bigger barns would secure his future, but the anxious person thinks that endless mental planning will secure theirs. There are some of you in this room, and I will put myself in the same category. I do this, actually. Every month, we sit down with our spreadsheets, and we put all our numbers into it, and we go through our budget, and then we calculate our net worth, and then we go, well, if I save this much, and if the economy does this over the next 10 years, then I'll have this much, but then you look at it and go, but if the economy doesn't, then I won't, maybe I'll have a shortfall, and you worry, and you plan, and ultimately, we do not know what the future holds. There's no way we can, and our worrying will never change that. We can be wise. We can try to plan, but sometimes we go too far in that planning. We try to account for every possible situation, and the truth of the matter is we can't account for every possible situation. It's in God's control. He can look at us and say, fool, you don't know what tomorrow holds. I think a lot of us in this room are people who by nature are planners. There's a lot of civil engineers in this room, and I'm glad that you are planners, and I'm glad that you're worried, because I don't want a bridge to collapse on me, so I hope that you worry a little bit. But in the same way, our worrying can go too far when it means that we're relying on ourselves and we don't rely on God. Worry, ultimately, and anxiety is the illusion of control without any of the benefits of actually having control. Third, they think that God's care isn't enough. The rich fool thought he needed more and more to be secure. The anxious person thinks that God's provision simply will not be sufficient. Ultimately, they both underestimate the exact same God. And like I said earlier, I think God doesn't rebuke people for planning or for thinking about the future. I think he rebukes people who have little faith that forgets ultimately who their Father is. And I think one of the big challenges is for us to have a large view of God, to not reduce God to someone who has the same struggles as we do, or to think that he is somebody who maybe isn't concerned with our plight, or to think that maybe somehow an economic downturn is actually going to knock Jesus off the throne and he's going to be as thrown by that as we are. None of those things are going to happen. Jesus is capable. 2 weeks ago, Mark kind of quickly shared a verse from Psalm 50. It was this, and the part that is important here I highlighted, Psalm 50, 21. God is rebuking the Israelites for doing all the right things, offering sacrifices, but having hearts that had really turned away from him. They'd reduced God in their minds. And he said, you thought that I was one like you, one like yourself. And after Mark shared that, I just spent a couple weeks really thinking about that, especially as I was preparing this message. And I went back and I read the entire passage there from Mark 50. I'm going to read it this morning. I'm not going to put it on the screen. If you want to follow along, you can. And it doesn't directly have anything really to do with our personal finances, except for I think it has almost everything to do with how we view God and, as a result, our personal finances. And so it starts off, verse 50, or chapter 50, verse 1, says, "The Mighty One, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth." Our God comes. He does not keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire. Around him, a mighty tempest. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people. "Gather to me, my faithful ones, who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge." Selah. Now, a lot of people think Selah just means like a musical term. It's a musical note. What I like to think Selah means is, hey, stop for a minute and actually go back and reflect on what you just read. So whenever I read Selah in the Psalms, I just stop and pause and go back and read what I just read and try to take it in a little bit more. And here's what I see here. God comes out of heaven, and he is the perfection of beauty, and he is shining, he is radiant. In front of him is a fire that consumes everything in its path. And there is a whirlwind, a tornado swirling about him. And the heavens and the earth start resounding about how righteous he is. This is a terrifying sight. When you read in the Old Testament about how people fall down as if they were dead in the presence of God, I think about this and think, that seems accurate. That's what I would do. He goes on, "Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God. Not for your sacrifices do I rebuke you. Your burnt offerings are continually before me. I will not accept a bull from your house or goats from your folds, for every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. And we love to stick that verse on a coffee mug, and it feels really good, but in the context of this, I don't know. I know all the birds of the hills, and all that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and all its fullness are mine. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and perform your vow to the Most High and call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you and you shall glorify me." And then he goes on and says, "You thought I was one like yourselves." And as I read that passage, what I think is, so often when I am tempted to go, I need to provide for myself, when I am tempted to worry about my financial future or how I will have enough or what the next 20, 30, 40 years will look like in my life, when good things come to me and I'm not tempted to be generous with it, but instead I'm tempted to hoard, what I realize is I'm actually saying, God is just one like me. He's incapable of providing for me. He's incapable of making my future better. What it means, I think, is that I have to be reliant, and I can't ultimately rely on a Jesus, a God who is good. And so what is the antidote for this? How do we deal with this? How do we apply faith to our finances? How do we let God control that? And how do we grow in that? Is it just a matter of going, well, I just got to give it away? I just got to buckle up and force myself to be more generous with my finances? What do I do about savings? How do I continue to think about it? And I think the place we have to start is somewhat a little different. We're going to finish up here in Luke 12:31. Says, instead, this is what Jesus says, instead, seek his kingdom and all these things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourself with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So really, I think there's two things here that he tells us to do. The first is to seek first his kingdom. I think we can't really take any right step with our finances. We can't truly apply faith if we don't first have a vision of how great and how wonderful and how glorious God is, of how good a treasure he is. If we don't understand that, yes, money can provide some degree of security, some degree of joy, some degree of comfort, but it can't provide ultimate joy and ultimate satisfaction. It cannot provide ultimate rest and ultimate comfort. Those can only come from God. And if today you don't fully believe that, the only antidote for that is to seek God. And like Hebrews 11:6 says, to trust, to believe that he will reward us, that as we seek him, that he will fill us with satisfaction. He will fill us with a sense of security, a sense of belonging. He will fill us with joy that is unexplainable, that even though we might lose everything, we feel completely cared for and provided for by a Father who's good and knows every one of our needs. That doesn't come by just mentally forcing ourselves to believe something. It comes naturally by spending time with a God who we know is good. In the same way that Micah could say, I'm going to give all this money away because this money actually doesn't mean anything to me. What matters is my mom and my dad who provide my food, my clothes, my toys, even the very allowance that I get to live on and buy the things I want. We seek first God. And I think that's what godliness looks like in our finances, is seeking God and putting him first. Secondly, and I think this becomes the outflow, and band, by the way, you guys can come back up. I think the second thing we want to do is we want to work to live more generously and to give more willingly. I think what we treasure is clearly indicated by how we spend our money. And if we treasure the salvation that God has given us, if we treasure the fact that God has literally laid down and given up everything so that we might be reunited with him, if we recognize that we have uncovered in that field a treasure of immeasurable value and we now possess that, any previous treasure we have becomes something that we can hold with a very loose hand. You may have saved some diligently for the future, and then God might call you to use it to help a family member, to help a neighbor, to help somebody who's in need in the church. Good, we should do that. We should be a body of people who are marked by our generosity, who are marked by our love for one another, not by people who are marked by hoarders who just have really large bank accounts and large 401ks. And we should trust the entire time as we plan for our future and as we look to the needs around us that God is ultimately in control, that he loves us and cares for us. Ultimately, I think the rich fool pleased himself and he called it his own provision. The anxious person, he feared for the future and he called it prudence. But those who would please God are people who would seek his kingdom and increasingly find it to be the greatest joy and a treasure that is worth giving up everything else for. The band's going to play one more song here. One of the lines of this song is just very fitting for this morning. It says, I'd give all my money, I'd throw it away, to stand in your presence and feel your light, or feel the light of your face. And the one thing I kind of joked as we circled up before the service, I said, maybe that should be flipped around. Maybe as we stand in his presence and we feel the light of his face, maybe it helps us loosen our grip on those temporary riches that we have today and say, God, this is all yours. And I am fully taken care of by you. I am in your hands. I don't need to worry about what tomorrow brings. I can trust you. I can trust you to plan. I can trust you to help me be disciplined. I can trust you with all the struggles financially I may face. And I can trust you that if I give, you will generously reward. Maybe not with money, but with satisfaction, with peace, with contentment, with a sense that our God is pleased with us. Let me pray. Dear Jesus, we thank you that, God, you give us the ability to navigate complex and difficult situations. And even though there's no way today we could cover everything that there is to cover as it relates to money and finances, God, I pray that as a church, we would be people who would apply faith as we think about our money.
And ultimately, we would be people who recognize that we have a Father in heaven who is our greatest reward, and that we would seek him with our whole heart. God, that you would replace fear and anxiety and worry in our lives with a restfulness as your children who know that you are a loving Father and that you care for us and that you know our needs before we even speak them. Help us to trust you more. Help us to rely on you more. Help us to be amazed by your beauty and your goodness. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.